May it please the court. Nicole Walker on behalf of the appellant Glenn Murray. Police had no reasonable suspicion to search Mr. Murray, so probation officer Collins overrode departmental procedures, circumvented the Constitution, and unreasonably detained Mr. Murray beyond the scope of a reasonable motor vehicle stop.
Let me stop you right there. If I understand your argument, it is based, at least in part, on the idea that there are rules and regulations relating to the treatment of probationers that involve contacting a supervisor and all that sort of thing, and that those steps were not followed here, right?
Correct.
Okay, so here's my question. What if the Department of Probation said, we're not going to provide any protections? We're not going to require supervisors to look at things over. We're not going to require you to have probable cause or reasonable suspicion or anything. Anyone who's on probation can be stopped walking down the street doing nothing and subjected to a search because you're a probationer. Would that be permissible?
No. Under the United States Supreme Court in Griffin versus Wisconsin, there are certain limitations, and this court has even held that, the entirety of their constitutional rights are not waived. And this court has also held that substantial compliance with the rules is necessary. But if Your Honor is saying that the rules don't apply in your hypothetical, we still have a problem here because the probation officer had no idea whether any of these people were on probation.
No, but what I want to know is how far could you go in that direction, assuming there were no rules limiting the manner in which a probationer could be stopped or searched?
Well, Your Honor, I think it would be the same as with police officers in particular when they don't know if someone's on probation, that they have to have reasonable suspicion of criminal activity. A probation officer would not be able to stop your car and be able to just ask for your identification to see if you're on probation. And that's essentially what happened here, although he was with police officers.
Okay, but maybe I'm going off on something that's irrelevant here,
okay.
But let's assume that a probationer is walking down the street and a police officer recognizes the person as being a probationer and decides, well, I just want to check things out. You know, he's got a knapsack on his back, and who knows what's in there. I'm going to stop him, and I'm going to search his knapsack. Assuming there were no regulations requiring that the police officer follow certain steps before doing that, would there be anything wrong with that?
Yes.
And what would be wrong with that?
Under Griffin versus Wisconsin, that the actual rights that an individual gives up relate solely to the assistance in the administration of probation. So if a police officer is walking down the street and sees someone, and we're assuming they recognize them as a probationer, they may be able to ask them their business abroad, but there's no reasonable suspicion there. And there's limits. And this court's said that, and the United States Supreme Court has said that. A probationer doesn't give up all their rights. And, in fact, the case law this court has dealt with probation has been that police cannot use probation to circumvent the Constitution, meaning there are limits on police searching probation.
Just to follow up on Justice Berger's question, let's assume hypothetically that parole probation rules did not apply to this particular case. They're basically out of the picture. Would that affect your analysis at all, or the result?
No, for a couple of reasons. One would be the police have to stay within the scope of the motor vehicle stop, so they can ask all the people for their identification. And once they did that, Mr. Murray, they found, had no warrants or anything. And under Holden, he can't then decide to pat him down and detain him further. So at that point, if we're not even dealing with probation, it was an unlawful detention before we went into any discussion about the bag. The minute they patted him down. And then if we have a probation officer there, we're stopping a car, he has no idea if he's on probation. So essentially, Your Honors would be saying, okay, probationers can act. He ran the ID of all three people after a motor vehicle stop. not knowing if any of them were on probation. Now, that clearly goes beyond their authority as probation officers within the rules, but additionally, that's not their function. They are within, their job is to properly administer supervision of probationers. Stopping, helping with the assistance of a motor vehicle stop to run their ID is certainly beyond their authority. And that is where the problem comes here. Even if, Your Honor, the rules say, well, if you see a probation officer, probationer, you can search him no matter what. He didn't know the person was a probationer. He didn't have that right. He could not come up to somebody. That'd be like saying that he would be able to come up to me and say, let me see your ID to see if you're on probation. He has no authority to do that.
I'd like to ask you about one of the circumstances that you're not focusing on, and that's Graham is in the back seat, and it's determined that there's a CAPIUS outstanding on Graham.
Correct.
Now, isn't it reasonable under that circumstance for the traffic stop to go longer than it otherwise would have just to issue a summons?
Perhaps, if they didn't ignore the whole situation.
Objectively, not what they subjectively did. Objectively, is it reasonable to extend the traffic stop under that circumstance?
Of him. Mr. Graham. That does not mean they automatically have the right to search the other individuals in the car.
Okay. Do they have, can they ask for consent to search?
So that's beyond the scope of the motor vehicle stop and beyond the scope of Mr. The problem we have here,
well,
too.
I'll tell you what's reminding me of these issues is there's a series of I-95 state police stops people who are speeding, and they ask, do you have any drugs or weapons in the car? No. Is it okay if I take a look? Yes. And as a result, they find drugs or weapons in the car. And those have worked their way through the federal courts, and valid consents have been found.
Mm-hmm.
So that prompts me to ask, was there a valid consent by Owens initially to search the bag?
No. And the reason for that is, at the time, there's several reasons, and we'll go down them in order. The first is, she, at that point, the motor vehicle stop was over. They issued her a verbal warning. They didn't even give her a traffic ticket. Now, first of all, I would argue that she doesn't have the authority to give consent because the bag was between Mr. Murray's legs. And even if she says it's mine, the circumstances belied that, and the trial court even said, he was in possession of it, and the prosecutor said, of course he had motive to say it wasn't his because he knew what was inside of it. But even if the court says, okay, she can give consent, and the consent was valid, that consent was cut off the minute Mr. Murray said, that's my bag. And then when he said, there's drugs in it, that was tainted by his unlawful detention. And so what we have in this case, the testimony was by one officer, Graham was not even asked to get out of the car. And one officer said, I don't remember. And another officer said he was out of the car. So clearly whatever his warrant was for was not sufficient enough for them to be concerned about their safety, or that would have come up. And it appears as though Mr. Graham's in the back seat of the car. It's Mr. Murray who's brought out simply because he's on probation. More important to the officers than the fact that someone's wanted. And that, again,
what was he on probation for? Is that in the record?
It's a good question, Your Honor. And I don't recall. I apologize. I don't recall at this time. I can see if it's in the record, but I don't remember. Assuming even if it was a violent offense, that still did not give the probation officer the authorization to just stop him. And he didn't even know that. He didn't know if he was on probation. And then he patted him down. He said, not only did he say, because he's on probation, I can do that, but he says, I looked to see if he had anything illegal. And then that does go beyond the scope of not only what police are allowed to do in a motor vehicle stop, but the regulations. And if we do look at the regulations, the probation officers cannot search anybody that's not clearly identified as a probationer. And they also, when they can search a probationer, there either has to be exigent circumstances, which there were none in this case, or they have to go through the procedures, the checklist, which he did not do. And part of what's defined as a search includes a frisk, if we assume he was frisking him, which he said he was looking for something unlawful, and the search is a search with view of discovery of contraband, which he said he was doing. In that case, he has to follow the checklist, at least to some degree, in order to be able to search him. And part of what's required there is sufficient reason to believe that the defendant has contraband. And in fact, if we look at the regulations, essentially, they're similar to what police are required to have. They cannot just walk down the street and search somebody because they think they're on probation. And that's the same with a police officer.
Ms. Walker, the problem I have is that the fact scenario from which your argument proceeds appears to start with a police officer witnessing a car speeding, through the city and following the car,
right.
Point zero in time is witnessing the speeding without anything ever happening before that time.
Right.
In this case, we have a whole another set of facts that precedes the car speeding.
Mm-hmm.
Your argument doesn't seem to take that into account.
Well, let's take it into account. The trial court took it into account and said that at the time they stopped the motor vehicle, the detective had no basis to stop them at that point in time for drug activity. So he found that. The facts were Detective Smith was in an unmarked car, driving past this car that was stopped. He sees two gentlemen behind the car who were talking. One
in a high drug area.
High drug area.
In the middle of the night.
Middle of the night.
As soon as they see his unmarked car, they do an about face and get into the car and they speed off.
Well, we don't know that for sure, because here's what happens. The two gentlemen are in the back, one briskly walks away, the other gets in the car. There's nothing to say he did that quickly or anything. The officer keeps going. He doesn't see what's happening next. He loops around. The car is gone. He doesn't know if it squealed its wheels to get out of there, took off. He sees them up the block, then sees them speeding. We don't know when they began speeding. They were only going to 50 miles an hour, and when he got onto I-95, they were going 70 miles an hour with the flow of traffic. Now, that's not to say that there wasn't speeding, but it indicates they weren't. There was no flight here because they didn't know that a police officer was following them.
You're saying that there was no suspicious behavior because the officer, if there was, the officer was not in a position to see it?
I say he had a hunch, and probably a good hunch, but it wasn't reasonable suspicion of drug activity.
Didn't the court find differently?
No, the court did not find differently. The trial court found that Smith, A65, Smith observed something which he believed may have been drug activity, but he had no basis to stop them at that point in time for the drug activity. He goes on to conclude that, but when he comes around, the car is gone. It's speeding, and now it's speeding in Wilmington and speeding down 95. They have a right to stop the car for the motor vehicle violations. So the state's brief is erroneous throughout the brief where it's asserted that there was reasonable suspicion trial court for drug.
So to make sure I understand your answer,
yes.
You're saying it's the court's finding that there was no basis before the speeding took place,
right,
to stop the car, mm-hmm, for suspicion of drug activity,
or correct,
to stop the people,
right,
on that basis. That renders everything that happened before the speeding essentially irrelevant to the analysis.
Well, he said he thought there was a hunch. And the court's findings, that was the court's
findings. But it is irrelevant to your analysis because of what the court
found.
Yes,
because the no one argued that. What they argued, what the state argued, and let's consider those facts, that he had a hunch that there was some drug activity. They pulled the individuals. They didn't even pull the driver out of the car. Her license and registration checked out. Now, if it was just her in the car, they issue a ticket or verbal warning and let her go. There are two passengers in the car, so they can ask them for ID. They do that. That's still all they can do with a hunch of drug activity and reasonable suspicion of motor vehicle stop. And so that, with that respect, it's irrelevant. But if we could factor it in and have the same results. And then, again...
Well, it's irrelevant in the sense that it has no legal consequence.
Correct.
What's your understanding of the record? You said they never asked the driver to get out of the car. She shows her license and registration, and they check out.
Yes.
And they gave her a verbal warning. In the normal course of events, they would have just said, slow down. What does the record show on why they asked Murray for his identification or Graham for identification?
There's nothing to indicate why they did that. All we know is that it was the probation officer. The two police officers approached the driver. The probation officer approached the passengers. They don't say why. So there's no real indication of that. But given the law and they're allowed to do that, we take it from there. And he has to stop when he finds out he's on probation. And there's nothing in there indicating otherwise. He could first of all, he shouldn't have been able to find out he was on probation because he's not really allowed to ask him anything because they're not clearly identified as probationers. But as soon as
you said they are allowed to do that.
I'm sorry.
What is it that was done by who that was permissible?
Okay, I apologize. The detectives were authorized to ask Owens for her license and registration. They did that. They could have even asked her to get out of the car, but they didn't do that. The police were authorized to ask the passengers to step out of the car. They did not do that. The probation officer did that. He is not permitted to do that because they're not clearly identified as probationers. But even if we assume he is permitted to do that, once he finds out that Murray is on probation and Graham has a warrant, he's done with Murray. He can't go any further under the rules or otherwise. And Graham, they could have arrested him, supposedly. They weren't even clear in the record as to whether they asked him to get out of the car. They were not concerned with him. Whatever his warrant was for was not sufficient enough to allow them to be concerned that anybody was armed and dangerous. And in fact, nobody argued that they believed anybody was armed and dangerous.
Your comment about or otherwise leads me to ask a question, which I'll accept your response that it's not pertinent. But it seems in past cases we've had some discussion about the papers that a probationer signs when he agrees to subject himself to probation as opposed to serving jail time or other alternatives.
Correct.
And those papers contains a form of waiver of constitutional rights. What's the relationship between that waiver and the rules that you're referring to that apply to probation officers?
That paper applies to, obviously, to the probationer. That doesn't relieve the probation officers from following the Constitution, which says even if you are on probation, there are certain rights that have to be adhered to. This court has time and again acknowledged that.
Well, some of the phraseology suggests that those rights are limited.
Correct.
Because he's on probation.
Right.
Tell us about that relationship. You're talking about the rules that the probation officer has to follow, which I, in my own mind, think of as a protocol.
Right.
In order to take certain actions. And we see the governor's task force in a relationship between the police and probation officers, and I have this image of a slinky as they move back and forth together, one exercising the powers he can, and then having the other exercise the powers he can, and in that way it's like a wedge through the infantry. What is the relationship between the protocol and the waiver?
The whole point comes down to, as Griffin states, it's to achieve the purpose of supervising and ensuring that the probationer is adhering to the conditions of his probation. Seeing whether or not somebody that I have no idea is on probation is speeding has nothing to do with probation. Absolutely nothing. And that's the first real problem here. To allow probation officers, simply because there's a police officer nearby, to go up to your car window and say, can I see your ID? I want to see if you're on probation.
Would the result in this case differ if there were no probation officers in the picture?
No, it would be a simpler answer that there was no, at the point where they issued or said, you know, found out there was nothing wrong with the license and registration, could ask them all out of the car, could pat them down, could not pat them down unless they believed that they were armed and dangerous, and could actually arrest Graham.
Well, a police officer could ask everyone to get out of the car.
He could.
Police officer, in this case, sees book bag or whatever it is in the front seat.
The probation
Yes. Well, in this case, it's a probation officer.
I'm sorry.
It's a police officer. Could the police officer then ask whose bag it is?
That goes beyond the scope of a motor vehicle stop.
Couldn't ask?
I don't believe so, because, and even if he could, at that point, he's going beyond, well, I don't believe so.
So he could not even ask Owens for consent to search the bag?
He could ask her, but I think that the circumstances would reveal, assuming he could ask her, the circumstances would reveal she did not have authority to give consent.
Okay, well, I could understand the point if she gave consent and had no authority to do that.
Right.
The bag was inspected, drugs were found, your client was charged. Then you could argue that he was done with Murray, should have focused on arresting Graham. But that's not what happened. What happened is your client says, that's my bag, there's drugs in there. Doesn't that pull your client right back into the picture?
No. He's unlawfully detained. He is outside the car. He's been patted down. He's not allowed in the car. The probation officer says, is this your bag? He says, no. He says, is this your bag? She says, yes. Can I search it? Yes. He goes to reach for the bag, and he, unlawfully detained, is saying, that's my bag.
So
there's drugs in it. And he's unlawfully detained, therefore.
Well, he's detained in the sense that he's there as part of a traffic stop, no, which hasn't ended as to Owens.
That is incorrect.
Isn't that what the trial judge found?
No, he found that under the rules, of probation, it was okay.
Well, and he said they have someone who is wanted. He also says they have a probationer. The traffic stop is not complete. So the traffic stop was on.
Well, that is incorrect to say that a traffic stop's not complete because they have someone who's wanted and someone who is on probation. The reality of what happened here was they were not investigating this warrant. They were stopping this guy because he was on probation. Therefore, it was unlawful, and he ruled at A66 that it was admissible under the consent of the driver or it was appropriate under probationary rules. That was his ultimate ruling.
Would you agree that if this were all done by a police officer and the police officer had could lawfully ask the driver if that were her bag, and she said yes, and then right after that your client said, no, it's not, it's my bag and there are drugs in it, that all of that would be admissible?
I think a continuum, to answer that question more accurately, it's the continuum of when that happens. If he's standing there and he's saying, okay, I need you to slow down, by the way, is that your bag? And she says yes, and it goes as you said, then perhaps that would have been lawful. But that's not what happened here.
Well, what I'm really trying to find out is whether putting aside the fact that we have probation officers mm-hmm. in the picture, that your argument proceeds from the premise that because this was basically a traffic stop occasioned by speeding, that there was no authority to ask anybody in the car about the bag that was lying there in plain view.
That's my initial argument. And then the alternative, I think it would be based on a continuum. If the court is going to find that in a motor vehicle stop they can ask that question, then it depends on, you know, if the stop is in suspended animation, as the court in Caldwell characterized it.
It would be very convenient if you had a case that stood for the proposition that neither a police officer nor a probation officer could could ask the driver or the passenger, is that your bag?
And this could be the case, perhaps.
Well, I'll take that response as one that says, I don't have such a case.
That's correct.
Thank you. By the way, so you don't jump up and get me embarrassed by having to say something to you, your time's up.
Okay. May it please the court, good afternoon, Chief Justice Steele, Justices Morgan Zern for the State of Delaware. Before the court today is a series of police decision points, all within a span of about 10 minutes, that began in a high drug area in the middle of the night in downtown Wilmington and culminated through an investigation into a roadside stop on the side of 95. Law enforcement acted properly at each of the decision points. Therefore, Mr. Murray tries to erect at least three walls to hide behind in order to disrupt that police decision making. The first is to try and limit the scope of a traffic stop. Loper clearly provides that law enforcement may obtain the identification and DELGIS status of all passengers in a car at a traffic stop and also ask everyone to exit the vehicle.
Law enforcement, meaning a probation officer as well as a police officer?
In this context, it was a GTF joint task force, and the court is aware of how Your Honor's analogy, I believe,
you don't have to accept my analogy. Take your point.
That they're working together in the GTF or Operation Safe Streets in this case.
Are you saying the authority of a probation officer who is working, you know, who's carrying out responsibilities as part of a joint task force are enlarged to that of a police officer?
I'm relying on the court's description in Kerrigan of the probation officer being a law enforcement officer in that capacity.
So you're saying there's no basis for purposes of this case to distinguish between the two types of officers?
Mr. Murray has offered no distinction as to Loper's ability, the ability under Loper to ask for identification and DELGIS status at a traffic stop.
I'm sorry, is your answer is there's no basis to distinguish?
There is no basis on it.
Okay. So we can treat in this case, the probation officer and a police officer interchangeably?
In this case, yes, where a GTF car responded to a request for assistance in investigating suspicious drug activity. This is not like the Culver case where the probation officer was used of leading.
Okay, so that's one wall.
Yes.
Second wall.
The second wall, Your Honor,
second wall that I'm concerned about is the finding of the trial judge that, regardless of what the police officer saw before he started to chase the car that was speeding, that there was no basis, no legal basis to stop the car on suspicion of drug activity.
Yes, Your Honor. The Superior Court did find a suspicion. That was the word on the record. It's not a reasonable, articulable suspicion. It's not, I would argue that the standard was not completely satisfied to stop the car solely on the basis of what Detective Smith observed in downtown Wilmington.
Okay, that being the case, how, if at all, can we take cognizance or account of what happened before the speeding took place?
The standard to expand the stop is one of the totality of the circumstances. And the officers, all of whom responded to the roadside, the ones that showed up to help, were told, I'm investigating some suspicious drug activity. Can you please come help me pull this car over? And after they responded and they got the DELGIS status, they found out that Mr. Murray was on probation for, in response to Justice Ridgely's question, a drug offense. And that's at A32 and A40 in the record. And knowing that the individual who had fled from the undercover vehicle to run around to get into the passenger seat was wanted for probation on a drug offense rises to the level of a reasonable, articulable suspicion to continue to investigate the drug activity.
Can we go back to your point about the authority of the probation officer? You seem to say that when you're working on the governor's task force, the probation officer is 100% equivalent to a police officer. Is that correct?
I would argue that, in fact, the probation officer, under the guidelines, has the ability to conduct searches that...
No, that's not my question. Let me make it a hypothetical. Let's suppose that the police officer walked up to the passenger side of the car, and the probation officer walked up to the driver and said, I'd like to see your license and registration. And then the probation officer said, you're under arrest for speeding. Could the probation officer do that?
I do not believe that the probation officer has the authority to effect a custodial arrest.
So then there's some limitation or there's some distinction, even though the police and the probation officer are working in concert.
Yes.
Now, go back to the facts of this case. It's represented to us that it's the probation officer who said to the passengers, not knowing either one was a probationer, get out of the car. What's the authority for the probation officer saying, get out of the car? We know that the police officer could arrest the driver for speeding, and we know that the police officer could say to the passengers, please get out of the car. My question is, what's the authority for the probation officer saying to the passengers in a motor vehicle stop, get out of the car?
In this case, probation officer Collins already knew that Mr. Murray was on probation when he asked Mr. Murray to get out of the car.
Because he recognized him.
Because he had run his DELGIS status.
So you're saying the facts would say that Murray handed his identification out the window while he was sitting in the car?
I believe that's the way, that's the record, yes.
All right, so then my question changes to, what is the authority for the probation officer to say to the passengers, please give me your identification?
That's the authority as a law enforcement officer on GTF.
Well, that's interesting, this melding of powers. Would that mean that the other side of the coin is equally applicable, that the police officers would have the authority to do what a probation officer would have the authority to do under the circumstances?
To do specifically...
Well, if there's this interchangeable sort of Vulcan mind meld that's taking place here between the authority of the police and the authority of the probation officer, it must work both ways.
My understanding is that GTF was created in so that each party may exercise the powers that it has in order to, as Ms. Walker said, affect the supervisory powers of probation.
Let's accept that they can each exercise the authority that each has. How do they transfer authority and act as the other under the circumstances?
As a threshold matter, this issue was not raised below and really was only crystallized on reply. So that's one thing to keep in mind.
I'll keep it in mind, but I'm still interested in this area of the law.
There's an absence of any support for the distinction, especially for something as minimal of an intrusion as obtaining identification and DELGIS status.
Well, but let's look at the Chief Justice's question specifically with what happened in this case, where you find out the person's on probation, and the probation officer says to the police officer, Murray, the passenger's on probation. Can the police officer say, oh, well, then I know he signed one of these waiver forms. I'm going to search him, the police officer. We understand that the probation officer could do that. My question is, if they're working together, each of them has all of the powers the other has, can the police officer search a probationer, or is that an action that needs to be done by the probation officer?
If the police officer had his own subjective, reasonable, articulable suspicion.
No, that's not
based
in my hypothetical.
Okay.
Simply knows he's on probation, signed a waiver.
I do not believe that would be proper.
But the probation officer could do that.
Under the guidelines, yes, he could.
Well, how do we sort this all out? Because if we're making these distinctions, and you've already told us two things, that the probation officer could not arrest the driver, and that the police officer could not search the probationer. We come back to a police officer can ask the passengers to get out of the car, but in this case, that didn't happen. The probation officer said, I'd like your identification. Why can the probation officer ask for the identification?
I don't not know the answer to that question.
So if we're going to try and deal with this morass, if it is one, we've got a fairly well-established pairing that goes on of police and probation officers. And it's understood that the purpose of that is to be able to enhance the enforcement ability of both groups, both the police and the probation officers. And I guess the question is, do we have to make a clear delineation between their respective powers, or is the fact that they are together in a collaborative effort, does that somehow indicate that we don't have to parse out who's allowed to do what?
On a practical level, because they do operate together, I suggest it would be very difficult to parse out those powers. For example, in this case, Mr. Officer Collins just happened to go to the passenger side of the vehicle where the individual just happened to be on probation. In order to impose a practical dividing of the seas between probation and police, at that point, if there is such a, you know, how would he know that he was on probation without asking? So I suppose then the police would have had to leave Officer Collins behind, approach everyone, get the identification, come back, report that there was a probationer, which one is he, send Officer Collins back up, and it truly interferes with the effective operation of Operation Safe Streets and GTF.
So would it be fair to say that from a practical perspective, there is and should be no distinction because all we're talking about really is a probation officer calling across the car to where the police officer is standing and saying, would you please ask these two people to give me identification?
Precisely.
And that the law shouldn't make distinctions that are, have no difference.
Precisely. In this case, were there to be a dividing of the powers between probation and police, it may have occurred, as Your Honor suggested, that police got the names, came back to the car, Officer Collins said Mr. Murray's on probation, and the events would have proceeded exactly as they did.
But aren't we forced to start with the premise that there is, in fact, a legal distinction between the respective authority of a probation officer and a police officer, although they're both law enforcement officers in a broader sense, in a generic sense? If there shouldn't be a distinction, why is there one? And does the mere fact that they're working together as a team somehow meld them into the same entity with equal authority to act under the same circumstances?
Particularly in such a minor intrusion as we're discussing here, which is obtaining identification.
Well, there are a lot of inconveniences, like the exclusionary rule, the requirement to get a warrant, probable cause, reasonable suspicion, limitations on detention, all those inconvenience law enforcement. But there's a basis for them. And my question is there a basis in law for a distinction between the power and authority of a probation officer as opposed to a police officer under the same factual circumstances? And does that distinction lose its meaningfulness if they're working together as a team?
My understanding is that their powers do derive from different sources, one being probation officers are officers of this court and are enforcing the sentences that this court hands down, the others being police officers. And the extent to which officers of this court to behave as such and do not have law enforcement powers to be arresting people.
Isn't that exactly why they work as a team? Because they recognize that probation officers can do things that police officers couldn't do and vice versa. And so our questions are, if they're working together as a team, because they each have different lines of authority, are the lines to be respected in a joint operation, or when they're working together in a joint operation, do the lines go away? And at least my understanding of your answer to some questions is no, the lines don't go away. But in this case, it was just a minor inconvenience.
But what's so different about this case that we can ignore what even you have to concede are differences, legal differences in the powers of these two different kinds of law enforcement officers?
Had Officer Collins not had probation in front of his name, the results would have been identical. It's a truly de minimis.
Well, that's like if pigs had wings, they could fly. I mean, that isn't what happened here. And so my question is, I suppose that a protocol could have been set up so that each of these respective officers were doing only what they were empowered to do, and if they wanted to go beyond that, they had to ask the other half of the equation to do it. That tap dance wasn't done here. Is that right?
That's correct. But and there are reasons for not requiring such a tap dance to be enacted every time.
Maybe practical reasons, but for better or for worse, I think that we're being asked to determine whether there are sufficient legal reasons.
And again, that I would dispute the fact that this is what your honors are being asked to do, because that issue was not properly presented on the record below, or in fact in the briefing before this court. But
from a strictly legal standpoint, and I'm asking this out of total ignorance, under the arrangement that created the governor's task force, was there a legally empowering document or order or legislation or any of the above that enlarged the powers of either of these two sets of law enforcement officers when they were working jointly? Or was it just simply an administrative arrangement?
Your Honor, I apologize. I do not know the answer to that question. I do not know the answer to that question, and I apologize.
Well, you would agree that a partial answer, at least to that question, would be that nothing abrogated probation officers' requirement to follow the administrative protocols.
That's correct. And in this case, Officer Collins did not. For both the pat-down, and he could have gone further. He could have simply searched the bag as opposed to asking to whom it belonged and could he have consent to search it.
But he would have had to follow the protocol first, wouldn't he?
Yes, Your Honor.
Which he didn't.
I was speaking strictly about the pat-down and the search. Once we get past the identification issue.
Right, and I'm talking about the pat-down and the search, too. I thought that for a probation officer to conduct a search, there has to be some contact with a supervisor explaining the circumstances and so on and so forth, and getting some approval to move forward. And that didn't happen.
The pat-down here was, in fact, in exigent circumstances. This was not a pre-planned, for example, curfew check or other instances where such administrative approval could have been obtained.
Why was it exigent?
They were in the midst of a 10-minute investigation following a high-speed chase, and there was the probation office. They didn't know if there were weapons. They didn't know what they needed to do, and they encountered Mr. Murray, found out he was on probation. He had been fleeing from the police for the past 6 to 8 minutes.
What's your definition of a high-speed chase?
Well, in this case, they were going 50 miles an hour through downtown Wilmington. I submit that that's high-speed.
Well, they were speeding.
And the office, Detective Smith, in his experience, believe that they were fleeing from him.
So, let's come back to what you're calling the issue in the case, you know, that is before us. The issue is that this, the contention is this traffic stop took too long. And your position is that the traffic stop didn't take any longer than was necessary. And putting aside the authority of a probation officer to do anything, he certainly was entitled to say, is that your bag?
Yes, Your Honor.
And if he was entitled just to be on the scene and say, is that your bag? And Murray said, it's my bag and it has drugs, then if we agree that the traffic stop didn't take longer than necessary, and the probation officer asked a question that Murray could have ignored but chose to answer, that's the end of the case from the state's point of view.
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Murray's statement was a voluntary statement in response to a question directed to Ms. Owens. Mr. Murray cannot, he seems to be trying to hide behind Ms. Owens' Fourth Amendment rights, and that's not something he's able to do. He was asked, was the bag his? He said no. If anything is any sort of fruit of a poisonous tree of anything that happened here, it was Mr. Murray's response that the bag was not his. And that was the end of the inquiry with regard to Mr. Murray.
As soon as Mr. Murray was detained, how long could he have legally been detained at the scene?
That would be the 2 hours within the 1902 stop.
Then what is the exigent circumstance?
That there may have been firearms, or certainly in this case, drugs that needed to be collected, and that there was may have been some fear that they were going to somehow dispose of the drugs or hide them or destroy them or needed to complete their investigation.
Well, why did they decide not to give the driver a ticket after taking them on a high-speed chase?
That goes to the law enforcement's belief that they were, in fact, investigating drugs, and that was their primary goal here, and not to hand out speeding tickets. If Your Honors have no further questions, the State will rest on its papers.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.